The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
It is News Talk's The Anton Savage Show, 10 to 12 on Sundays, 9 to 11 on Saturdays. And the Sunday Independent is this morning suggesting that there is doubt being cast on the latest deadline for the completion of the Children's Hospital. Maeve Sheehan in that paper reporting that the HSE board warned of the risk of completion date for the €2.2 billion project. Apparently the board was told 6 weeks ago that the hospital may not be finished by the agreed, most recently agreed, June 2025 deadline, raising, as they describe it, fresh concerns about the certainty of the project's completion date. Joining me now is Paul Davis, who's a lecturer in procurement in DCU. Paul, is it beyond the bounds of capacity of the system to actually just agree a date and have people land on it?
I think it is at this stage. I think there's so many moving parts to this particular operation that we're now looking at the very end times of trying to finish it off. So I think it is beyond the system to be able to give you a predictable date. I think the last phrase that was used and was bandied about was substantially completed. In other words, it was finished, but we still had other bits and pieces to do. So now we're hearing that it's going to drag on another short while. But it's like most building finishes. There is always little things to be done. It's 6,000 rooms. It's a massive building. So it was never going to be expected to be fully completed for June, I think. I think that the concern is not so much the building completion, it's the handover and then the time taken then to get it up and running. That's probably where we're now seeing it. So we're seeing an additional 3 months being added to the expected timeline for the commissioning stage of it. I think that's going to run longer.
Now, given that you're expert in all things procurement, are there lessons to be learned from the manner in which this was procured? Because it seems to have been a rolling battle between contractor and contracting entity, that being the Irish state, ever since this thing started.
I think there is, and I think what we will find with the maternity hospital, at least what we're hoping with the new maternity hospital, is that the design is practically complete as they've gone to tender. And in theory, that should deliver a hospital quicker, but also more on time than this particular one. The procurement issue here was that we went to the marketplace without having a design in place. And we've done ad hoc design decisions. I think we're in excess of 3,000 small changes. And these small changes are significant when you start adding them up over the course of the years. So what has happened here is go to the market, no finished design, make the changes, and then we build on. I think the lessons have been learned that we know this is not the way to do it. The question is, do we have the skill sets inside the system to be able to deliver in the same way, or are we going to use the same set of skills that have been on this hospital for the National Maternity?
And is the critical issue at the heart of this, what I think that the acronym MEAT, the most economically advantageous tender, is the fact of having to some extent to drive price to the base level, although this has been quite an expensive journey, it has to be said, this hospital, but the objective to do so, does that mean that you lose flexibility and control in the end contract?
Actually, no. If they had used the MEAT criteria properly in this particular case, then price should have been down at the 20% mark. Instead, price was 70%. So price was the dominant characteristic. It broke all the MEAT rules in terms of most economically advantageous tender. It actually drove the price down. And so the only way for anybody to recover who was bidding in was to look for changes in order to be able to deliver it. I think going back to when this bid came in, and again, I think the documents for the other two suppliers who bid in have been destroyed since, which is a shame because it would have been good to see them. But we were looking at the other two bidders into the market, looking at almost 200 million more expensive than the nearest bidder, which is the one that won it. So the question was then, why did we use a price-only competition, which is at 70%? If we had to use the most economically advantageous, put price at the lower end of it, and then managed all the other deliverables, like on-time completion, like the actual delivery of the systems and everything else, then we probably wouldn't be in this situation that we're in. But we went after price, and that was a bad procurement decision at the start.
Paul, thank you very much. Paul Davis, lecturer in procurement in DCU there. I'm joined by Alva Smith, activist and campaigner, Joan Mulvihill, digitalisation lead at Siemens, and Pather Tobin, leader of AIM2. Pather, I saw you sort of nodding along with much of what Paul had to say.
Yeah, no, the lack of specificity at the start of the whole process. So to design a contract and a tender process where you don't have enough detail in it creates an enormous gap where the contractor can actually fill that gap with lots of changes throughout the process. And that's the really frustrating element about this. And, you know, we have seen thousands of rooms changed over and over and over again. One room, I understand, had 125 different changes to it, which is quite incredible. And
now, are they significant? Or are they the kind of things that in any contract you have snags, you say it to the builder, and if there is a decent working relationship, it just gets solved?
Some of them are significant. So, for example, even in 2024, in January, it was decided that there were problems with the ceilings. So the ceilings didn't have the right water sprinklers, smoke alarms, lights, ventilation. So they decided that, you know, three quarters of the rooms, and there's a lot of rooms, had to have all the ceilings changed. And that took about 6 months to change all of those ceilings. So my worry is, and, you know, the National Maternity Hospital was mentioned there, my worry is, and I've actually seen the bill of quantities for the National Maternity Hospital, it again is lacking specifics in its detail, which again could allow for future contractors to change radically over and over again the construction. And, you know, we're doomed, I think, to repeat our mistakes if we don't learn from our mistakes. And there's no sense in government as of yet that they admit that the process was wrong from the start, that Simon Harris, who signed the contract at the start, made a mistake and he needs to put up his hand, and there needs to be accountability for that. And we need to get into a situation where there's a cost to those mistakes. And we had this conversation before, actually, we came on air, that the state should take more care in actually spending public money than anything else. Because, you know, the idea that public money is worth less than private investment is absolutely wrong. Like, I support the public delivery of services massively. I want to be confident in it. But the way that public money is being spent at the moment is eroding confidence significantly.
I mean, I actually think that the cost overrun is just a joke of a word in relation to the National Children's Hospital. I mean, it is actually quite scandalous. And
2.2 billion.
Exactly. Not only should we learn lessons from it, although who is going to actually write down those lessons and who is going to learn them, but who is going to be held accountable for this? There is no process of accountability either. And I think that that's a huge problem in relation to these incredibly costly projects, because we have not only the National Maternity Hospital, but we also have Metrolink coming on now, which is already, you know, spiralling in all kinds of profoundly worrying, disturbing directions, when we know that we are also going to face economic difficulties over the coming years. There's very little doubt about that. I'm sure we'll talk about it later. So where is the accountability, and exactly what are the lessons that we need to learn? Will somebody please write them down in the Oireachtas and make sure that they are learned for homework?
John, please. You wanted to come in?
I just want to say, on a practical level, I hear what you're saying, and I wouldn't be about letting ministers off the hook. And then you have to ask, to what extent is any minister, a lot of them at the time inexperienced, have, and those kind of major construction projects. But then you have to ask about who's commissioning them. You know, within departments, there are officials there, and that is comes down to accountability. It's not to let ministers off the hook, but there are paid public servants whose job it is to be an expert in these things. The other thing, and I'm listening to, in horror, to Padraig's example about the ceilings, which is just horrific to me. But it's the idea that, why do we not have a standard? Like, a ceiling in a maternity hospital, I'm assuming, will need the same sprinklers and fire systems as a ceiling in any other kind of hospital. So how do we get to this kind of modular state of building public sector buildings that says, this is the standard? That's the thing that goes into a tender, you know, so that you do know what your costs are going to be. And you do know the operating system that you're going to have, the building management system that
although
you're going to have.
Presumably both counterparties in this instance will say it is a hugely complex thing to build
a huge giant.
But we have, the world has been building hugely complex buildings for a lot of time. We do not, it is not unique. I mean, obviously I'm a little biased. I work for Siemens. So we are involved in very complex build projects, whether it's, you know, large manufacturing sites and plants and commissioning and large public buildings. But there are standards. There are standards around the latest technology for building management systems, the latest technology for fire, safety, security. and you say, that is the standard of which all of these buildings will be. This is how we're going to spec it. The idea that you go in blind to that is absolutely ludicrous.
How does that mean?
Joan's right. Like, you know, in these departments, you have ministers, you have junior ministers, you have private secretaries, you have chairs, you have audit committees. Everybody paid big money and none of them doing their job in relation to this. The key ingredient difference between the public sector and the private sector at the moment is if this happened in the private sector, somebody would have lost their job. And there's never any cost at senior levels of the civil service to people wasting this level of money. Like 300 million euros has been spent on Metro without a shovel being put into the ground. Dublin Bus bought 100 electric buses that never moved an inch for 18 months because someone forgot to put in a planning application for an electric charger. The government spent 20 million euros on ventilators that never worked, that are now costing 50,000 euros a year to keep in a storeroom. And the other side of this debate that never really gets discussed is this complete waste and breakdown in public delivery is actually costing it because these construction are grinding to a halt. So much needed infrastructure that we all need to help our lives is really slowing down now in its delivery, which, you know, is a disaster in real terms.
Alva, you were mentioning about lessons that needed to be learned in this. The other question you'd ask about whether or not lessons are learned is about the process that gets you even to the starting blocks, because the Children's Hospital spent, 15 years before we managed to get a site and planning for it. If you look at the Dublin Airport attempt to lift the cap, we are years into the discussion that we seem nationally incapable of accelerating things like that.
Well, delivery is a huge problem, as we know, in this country. That we're very good at having these brilliant ideas, but delivery is really poor. Just the whole housing situation. We absolutely, definitely need expenditure control mechanisms, which are much more, which follow through, which actually follow different kinds of building processes. But we also, it seems to me, need to send the people who are on all of these committees and the heads of this, that and the other, as you were saying, Pater, we need to send them off to Denmark or to Norway or to Sweden or wherever it is, where they actually build hospitals for half the price. Because not only did they get the ceilings wrong and the sprinklers, what is absolutely beats me completely is they got the operating theatres wrong. So that a huge changes had to be made 3/4 of the way through the process. Now, they were building a hospital. Did they not know that when they started up? So I'm, you know, shivering in my boots for other reasons as well with regard to the National Maternity Hospital, to think what kind of damage can be done there and what's it going to cost and who suffers as a result of all of this? It is the taxpayers, we can say the taxpayers, but fundamentally it is actually people in this country who do not have enough to live on, who really are on the breadline, who don't have access, who have access to a health service which doesn't look after them, who have access to social care which doesn't actually look after them. That's the bit. We're throwing money away when there are people who are desperately in need. And that is an absolute disgrace.
Is it fair, Pather, to draw the private sector correlation? Because at least in the private sector, you are likely to have one individual or a small group of individuals who would be tasked with both probably procuring and then managing the delivery of the project. This is one of those where it has many fathers. I mean, there are various different departments involved. There are various different arms of the state involved. There's a separate company responsible for the delivery versus the procurement. It is a complex entity in a way that it's not normally for the private sector.
But listen, this is the monument to government waste. But we have lots of smaller monuments as well. And like we have literally every week had, you know, the bicycle shelter, the security huts, the WRC wall, the Great Wall of Tara, which took 12 years to build. Like, you know, we could go on for any amount of time in discussing projects that are being handled by the state that are taking so long. And the key ingredient is the lack of cost, the lack of accountability. You know, if any of us, in any of the tens of thousands of people who work in private businesses at the moment, wasted as much as some of these departments and senior civil servants are wasting, they would lose their jobs. And that is the motivational factor to make sure that they stay in the parameters and reach high standards.
No, can I want to add something.
Sorry.
I really do, because I'm listening to this and I'm sitting here wryly amused at the possibility, because I get your point, Anton. We're comparing the public sector to the private sector. So what happens when you let a private sector person go in and look after government efficiency? I think it's called DOGE. I'm just laughing at the prospect of some Elon Musk in Ireland coming in saying, I'm going to show you how to do it right. So it's finding that happy balance. The private sector, just to be fair, is not always perfect either. The public sector is not perfect.
But there has to be a way of doing it better. Yes,
for
but we
sure.
We have a controller and auditor general in this country, for example. And I want to know the specifications of the job, the controller and auditor general, because I think that that outfit is not doing its job at the moment.
I think the key solution in between both of these points is, first of all, the controller and auditor general looks at the issue after the fact to a certain extent. And what we would like to see is a junior minister whose job it is to measure public projects as in real time.
More layers of bureaucracy.
To be one junior minister to be in the minister, the Taoiseach's office, and to report to the Taoiseach on a weekly basis. Imagine putting the Taoiseach on the hook for projects that are...
But do you not think with this level of overrun that we need a senior minister in there doing it? Because somebody needs to take charge
of
the situation.
But I think the whole point is that most ministers, this is the point, are not experienced in managing large infrastructure projects. So their capacity to get under the hood and understand what is going on is the reason. It doesn't take a senior minister or a junior minister. It takes somebody who is deeply experienced in running large infrastructure projects, which is a different skill set. And it is not a public sector elected one.
The ministers are not selected for technical skills in this country. They're not selected for the ability and the work that they had outside of politics, because actually most ministers in this country are lifetime politicians who have no experience outside of politics. They're usually selected because of geography and lots of other political reasons inside political parties. But I do think that
they're not given technical roles, they're given policy roles.
We do need people with some level of technical know-how.
But is that not in our public service?
But the problem is, I've spoken to ministers and they've said to me that when they go into a department, they have 20 or 30 people with degrees and PhDs and 20 years of experience to tell them 101 reasons why something can't be done. And after a while, these ministers become vehicles on their bus rather than the drivers of their bus. And if you're not coming to the table with some one moral compass and two technical knowledge, you are going to end up driving a bus with somebody else.
But it is the responsibility of the senior minister anyway to, although we shouldn't be talking about senior and junior minister, the responsibility of the minister to manage their department, his or her department.
But the difficulty then that you hit, Alva, is that when you get to something like the Children's Hospital, it has been through so many hands. If you look at what ministers, it's probably been eight of them have had hands on in some way.
So there are big questions to be asked about our public service as well. But, I mean, that is for certain, because it's big. I don't know how we compare absolutely with other countries, but we have it's a pretty bulky public service.
Let us move slightly in that case, because one of the areas which is getting an awful lot of discussion this weekend is exactly that, is the analysis of the public service and the analysis of the health services, because we are now 5 years on from COVID and there is mass discussion about, do we need a COVID inquiry, which goes to the heart of exactly what you are describing. Do we need to dig all of that back up and see how well we did or didn't do? And if so, what nature should the inquiry be? Joe Duffy writing, I think, in the Indo today, saying that we don't need to replicate the BBC's blame, or not BBC's, the British blame-seeking style of inquiry.
I kind of have to agree with you. I'm very practical. So coming from this private sector mentality, I would have to say I would weigh a probability and say, well, what is the probability of this happening again? What is the probability of us making the same mistakes? And what are we going to achieve by having an inquiry, which is to blame a load of people who are all off living their lives now? And a lot of people...
Yeah, you were just the one asking for accountability.
No, I was. But for something that we can actually make real change on. So if we have accountability on public spending and say, right, okay, we will not make those mistakes again, the probability of us having a large infrastructure project again, very, very high, very, very frequent. Let's not be making that mistake. And again and again and again. What is the probability of us having a global pandemic again? Just relatively speaking.
100% certain.
100% certain, but the probability of it happening in quick succession soon. And then also the same people being there, they're all gone, right? Okay, so that's part of it.
So hang on, so your logic is this is unlikely to kill millions of us anytime soon, so let's not bother.
No, I'm not saying. I said, what is the point? What are we going to get out of the inquiry? Unless an inquiry has a very clear kind of, I suppose, intention about what
inquiry is not just about blame. It can't be about responsibility and accountability, it's about learning the lessons again.
What would we do better next time?
What did we not do? Yeah. What did we not do at all last time? And what did we do
wrong? What would we do better?
And actually, I'm not sure that we need an inquiry which has to go on for years, because I think that we do know a lot of this is out there already. We know what happened to older people. We know what is happening to children.
Nice. And so to that practical point, I just wanted to add, that's it. It's pretty straightforward. The idea of going into this big, wasting loads of money again,
but
doing
a big inquiry. We do need a process which actually looks back at that and which says, okay, which sets out this is what we did wrong and this is what we need to do differently within maybe the next 5 years.
I think the government doesn't want a COVID inquiry. The government doesn't want an investigation into its own actions during COVID in the first place. There's no doubt about it. During COVID, there were thousands of older people moved from hospitals into nursing homes without actually being tested for COVID. That the state actually moved thousands of older people and seeded COVID in nursing homes during that period of time. That nursing homes closed their doors and that the state turns around and said, no, you've got to open your doors again to let people come in and seed COVID in those nursing homes. The nursing homes were the ground zero of COVID and thousands of people died in those nursing homes. The biggest death in any state institutions in the history of the state, and we're not going to even have an investigation into this. The government is having a COVID look back in relation to this. There's going to be no powers of compellability in terms of people or papers. Anybody who is called to this, who doesn't want to go, can give their two fingers and say, I don't want to appear in this. NPHET, which met in private, in behind closed doors, will be discussed by a inquiry which will be happen behind closed doors.
Oh, well, that's
it's an incredible situation.
But surely, Padraig, they will say you have to balance individual rights to not be castigated, to not have private business disclosed in a way that will have them introduced on social media, if you want people to be honest and forthcoming in these inquiries.
Well,
no,
I personally don't want a witch hunt of individuals in relation to the decisions that they made, because everybody in that scenario is going to make decisions that are wrong sometimes. And people need the space to make wrong decisions at times, because if you can't make a wrong decision, you're not going to make any decision. But you've got to realise that domestic abuse went through the roof over the period of COVID, because many women were locked into the locations of that abuse. 95,000 children were referred to TUSLA last year, which is 45,000 more than about 5 or 6 years ago, in large part because Ireland closed its schools longer than any other country in the whole of Europe. We were the only country in the whole of Europe to close down the building of homes in terms of that whole process. And we have the worst housing crisis within the country. We need to make sure
but the government will say, but lives were saved as a function of that.
Well, another part of this investigation we need to look at is the fact that Ireland has been beset with excess deaths since COVID that nobody is looking at, and nobody's asking questions to why that happened. And I'll tell you, one of the biggest things for me, and I have an experience in this, cancer services were closed down in a significant level during COVID. I had cancer myself during COVID, and you know, many, many people did not have access to cancer services. Breast cancer screening was shut down during COVID. There was a tidal wave of more advanced cancers as a result of it, which, you know, the state has, it's nearly impossible to deal with those, and many people lost their lives as a result. So on the round, it was a very difficult period of time. Difficult decisions were necessary, but we really do need to be very straight in the mistakes that were made.
John, you want to come in?
Yeah, I guess what I don't want to do is be flippant towards the people who did suffer hugely during COVID. And I think there is a need in the public, particularly for people who lost people, who were, you know, as I say, who suffered under, whether it was domestic violence, their cancer treatment, what, all of those things, all of those repercussions. There's a lot of people who need closure on what happened and who feel the need that they never got answers for why did this happen to them or how we could have done things better. So when I say no to an inquiry, I'm not saying no to an inquiry, but I don't think, when I look at the faces of the people that were featured in the paper there, I don't think any of those people ever got up in the morning during COVID to do something that they did not believe in that time with the information they had available to them was the right and best thing to do. I believe that. I believe of them that they are good people. They were going to get paid the same money whether they did it or they didn't do it. They got up every day to do what they thought was best with the information that was available to us at the time. We now have more information. We now have learned what has worked and what has not worked. That is the bit that we need to And I take this in a positive way. Say, right, okay, now, not about blame, but what would we do differently? If you were to get those 10 people into that room who are the big decision makers and say, what would you have done differently? That is it. Capture the learning so that when and if this does happen again, we will make better decisions. But that is where you have to come from it and to give closure to the people who suffered.
But what is, you know, what I find absolutely extraordinary is that we, not just us here, obviously, but generally, that we can even be having a debate and a conversation as to whether or not there should be an inquiry. Of course there needs to be an inquiry. It was an absolutely appalling and catastrophic event of a very considerable duration. It will happen again. It could happen again next year. It could happen again in 5 years' time. We absolutely have to understand what we need to do better next time. And even more importantly, we need to have the structures in place and being put in place now that ensure that our health service doesn't go absolutely down the tubes, as it did for so many people, as Pat was saying. Well, that our lives depend on this and the lives of our children and our grandchildren.
Interesting text in relation to, Pather, what you had said about the thing of the unintended seeding of COVID into the nursing homes. That assertion about nursing homes being seeded is exactly why we need an inquiry to decide whether or not there is any truth in assertions like that being accepted as fact, which I don't think you would disagree with, that it is the kind of thing that is useful to investigate and to see the facts around it. Another in respect of the Children's Hospital and accountability for COVID, when something this big goes wrong, it's unreasonable to expect that it can be blamed on a handful of individuals. So looking for accountability is a pointless exercise. Learning lessons, however, is vital, and everyone involved in the process should reflect on what happened and what they think could have been done better so that other projects can learn this very expensive lesson. If you have a view, 53106 or 087 1400 106 on WhatsApp. We were probably all at the point where we thought we could take our focus away from diplomatic relations with Donald Trump for a while, that Patrick's Day was over. According to the Mail on Sunday, he's on his way over here, or at least he's being invited to a state visit if Simon Harris gets his way. We'll talk about that after this break.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
It is the Anton Savage Show, 10 to 12 every Sunday and 9 to 11 every Saturday. Joan Mulvihill, digitalization lead at Siemens, is with us, as is Pather Thobeen, leader of AIM2, and Alva Smith, activist and campaigner, who no doubt is delighted at the prospect of Donald Trump doing an official state visit and addressing the Houses of the Oireachtas.
Well, I think it would be he'd be a very foolish man to come here. Now, let me start off by saying that, because there are a great many people in this country who would not be very pleased to see him arriving down here on top of us, given the absolute, I can't even express my anger with Trump at the moment when we have this man saying, I'm all about peace, I want peace. And as soon as he mentions the word peace, it seems as if the entire world starts rearming itself and talking about nuclear deterrence. So, and that's only the very tip of the iceberg. Joan was talking about
realpolitik, Alva.
But realpolitik tells us that we do not need to have Trump actually coming here. And if and when he does actually impose 200% tariff on Irish whiskey, I'd say we certainly won't be wanting him to come here, because that's a little bit of our industry that's going to go straight down the tubes, right down immediately. I can't understand this talk of immediately saying, let's invite Trump, or we have invited Trump. I mean, what the Taoiseach actually said, I think, was something about you're welcome here, you're welcome to come here.
Well, to put it in context, John Lee, who is the political editor with the Irish Mail on Sunday, spoke to Taoiseach and Foreign Affairs Minister Simon Harris. Simon Harris said, look, there is always a standing invite for any US president, but this one in particular loves a bit of pomp and flattery. I'm paraphrasing significantly here. But let's get him over. Yeah. Let him address the House of the Oireachtas.
But there's a big difference between, you know, pomp and flattery and major protests in the street. I remember the Reagan protests. In fact, I think I was a steward or something, and actually lived in fear thereafter that I had maybe been caught on camera, would never be allowed into the USA again. But I think that people would rightly protest against a Trump
visit. Should they stage manage all that?
Please, you know, a protest is a protest. And we would be saying we do not want this vile person. I really do think he is a very unacceptable person. We do not want him here. We do not want his politics. We do not want to be associated with that. And there are many of us who would not have been in favour, indeed, of Micheál Martin going to visit him at all.
You would have gone that far. You would have said we're not sending the Taoiseach.
There is something. It was very, I think, Martin acquitted himself without becoming a casualty. But there is something to me morally unacceptable about smiling and shaking hands with the man who has cut US aid, for example, around the world, who is obliterating. Who's obliterating any mention of LGBTIQ people in research, who is undoubtedly misogynist, of that I have no question, no doubt whatsoever, who is giving Elon Musk free rein to absolutely dismantle the American public service, including education, including health, including regulation of all
kinds. But on the counterpoint to that, though, is the very people that you talked about who are most on the margins, what pays some of the services provided to them is US multinational investment in this country. And if he acts in a way that damages that, he acts in a way that damages people in this country.
Well, We have to find a better way of dealing with this. We have to understand that, of course, our economy is important, but we also do have moral commitments and we do have values and we do need to be able to feel that we can respect them and that they are respected by those who represent us.
Well, Pat, is the line that we cross in terms of our morals and our values the point at which we invite Donald Trump to talk in the Oireachtas?
Well, I just think Simon Harris has changed his tune from calling Trump a ghoul there a few years ago to a situation where he's inviting him now for tea in Ireland. I'm conflicted in relation to Trump. There's much I disagree with Trump in relation to. But it's funny, I marched, like many hundreds of thousands of people, against American intervention in the likes of Iraq many years ago. And yet Trump is now, you know, has a much more isolationist instinct. And I actually would like to see America involved in less foreign wars. I think Trump's line around the Riviera in Gaza and the ethnic cleansing is horrendous. But I actually think that, you know, Trump probably did more for a ceasefire in Gaza than the Biden administration ever did. And I think, you know, now that...
But at what cost?
But look, there is a... And I listened to the Palestinian ambassador in relation to this, and she very firmly states that Trump was involved in pushing for a ceasefire in Gaza, which is quite incredible. And I remember Blinken going around the world promising a ceasefire. And actually, the Democrats didn't mean what they said in terms of that ceasefire. It was more a press statement in advance of a US election than it was a real effort to gain the ceasefire.
Do you want him in the Oireachtas?
Listen, I do think that Ireland is the most exposed country in terms of tariffs in the whole of the European Union.
Yes or no, Padder?
I think we've no choice. The cat's out of the bag in terms of this particular issue. I think that we are potentially looking down major falls in GDP, in jobs, in corporation taxes in this country. We could potentially see a situation where we are cutting back in terms of budgets, where we're actually no longer spending the same on investment in infrastructure, that we're actually increasing taxes. If this all goes wrong, we need a situation where we protect the Irish economy and Irish business. And if that means trying to do our best to influence US decisions, I think we need to use our efforts to influence
the
US
only thing
decisions.
Is, if you look at the road to the White House, it is paved with the corpses of the most sycophantic. Those who have gone out of their way to flatter the new king have regularly been flung under the bus for so doing.
Yeah, listen, I do think actually Micheál Martin was sycophantic in his meeting with Trump over the last week. I think it was quite shocking that he laughed his way through the whole issue of the housing crisis, that he laughed his way through the Conor McGregor discussions.
That was disgusting.
You know, I do think that, you know, you can be respectful, decent, and still engage.
Oh, it's a fine line.
It is a fine line, but I think Macron and Keir Starmer did a better job, I think, than Micheál Martin did.
Well, you could choose not to go in the first place. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, if you'd asked me this question 3 weeks ago, I'd have said, no, we shouldn't have gone. That was just a personal view. I was like, going, and I saw a really cool Vox Pop, and some young women, like they're in their 20s, were asked, and they said, I would not entertain that. And another woman said, just take a sickie. And then the guys that were interviewed in the Vox Pop, and I don't know whether it was a gender thing, they said, well, you know, business. I was on Instagram yesterday morning, as you do, and I listened to Jane Feary. She's a really cool coach. And she said, you know, you can never never confuse your values with virtues. Your values don't have to be virtuous. And it sounds crass to say your values shouldn't be virtuous, but it was almost like you can value economic prosperity. Now, it doesn't sound like a beautiful ethical value, but it is a practical value. And by valuing that, we have to value the commercial relationship that we have with business leaders whose businesses are here. And then I think I wouldn't have gone. And then I saw how it went. And I thought, I don't think Micheál Martin did a bad job. I really don't.
Do you think he should come to the, should he stand up at the Dáil and address Biden?
But my next part is, do I think he should come here and address the Dáil? Absolutely not.
Another thing I want your view
on. He would be shouted down. I mean,
I think
even though they're all very well behaved.
When I think about climate, for example, you know, we're talking about effectively a climate change denier. He is virtually a vaccine denier as well, with
Kennedy
person as health.
Just a second. I am conflicted about this for sure. But I will say I do come from the Good Friday Agreement school of politics, where you do sit down and engage with the people you most disagree with, and sometimes who you find most damaging to your own worldview. And that actually is true engagement, that actually sometimes you can achieve some kind of common ground, that you can bring people to you. And sometimes when both sides of the debate just refuse to engage with each other, the world is worse for that.
But we were talking about this earlier on. Ireland do not exist on their own. We are part of the EU. So any tariffs that are imposed on Ireland are not imposed in Ireland. They're imposed on the EU. These are not bilateral arrangements between Ireland and the US. These are arrangements. These are tariffs that are imposed between the two trading blocs, that is the United States and the EU. So we now actually have an interesting role to play in our relationship with the EU, because he doesn't seem to hate Ireland as much as he hates France, as much as he hates
Germany.
Although
he did say that pharma was on the way back to the US.
And so this was my next point. And Alva made the point about booze. Booze is significant in terms of our trade, but not nearly as significant when you put that into context of life sciences, pharmaceuticals and technology. And we have joked conveniently for years that we are the 51st state. But be very careful what you wish for, because we might.
Because I'm coming to you on Facebook in a second. Go, Pat.
Yeah, just briefly, like there's about 50 billion euros worth of exports in pharma and chemicals from Ireland. Where the actual tariffs go in terms of European products is really key here. And we need more influence both with the US, but also in terms of the EU.
Yes.
The EU decision actually to put a tariff on bourbon straight away opened Irish whiskey to a retaliation. And I don't know what influence we have currently with regards to von der Leyen's
decisions.
If we get
to the services sector, hips, stents, contact lenses.
I don't know what influence
Botox,
the government
Niagara.
Has
really
made. The point has also been made that, you know, the big companies, they also want their foothold in Europe because of the big market. So, you know, it's not quite as black and white as we think.
Now, on the topic of big FDI in Ireland, what is your view on this, Joan, briefly? The metamorphosis is how the Sunday Times is describing it. This is the woman who was one of the senior executives in Meta, who has written a book, and Meta and Facebook, in their constant desire to foster free speech, have taken out an injunction saying that it's defamatory, shouldn't be published, and trying to stop her promoting it.
Oh, shock horror. You know, I love the play on words. First of all, metamorphosis. So obviously, Meta have gone from this lovely little playful, let's connect all the people in the world, it'll be so nice. And then people blindly drunk on the Kool-Aid chasing unicorns thought, oh my God, he's so cute. And obviously, so Sarah Wynne Williams was a senior public affairs person from New Zealand. She wrote this book and it was a great big takedown on Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg, the other bad guy. So he's less bad in some respects, but profoundly bad all the same. And so she wrote this whole book about how profoundly bad he is, and how that he was basically somewhere between a toddler and a teenager,
Doesn't get up to lunchtime, she says.
Ah, you know, but he doesn't have to. He wouldn't get out of bed for less than, at least a billion. So anyway, she's done a bit of a takedown on this, wrote this book as a whistleblower, and they've taken out an injunction and predict the book has been published. So what she's not allowed to do is promote it. So I think it behoves all of us to promote it as much as we possibly can.
How do they square that? How do you square saying we can't fact check, we can't control defamation, we stand for free speech, we need to be
except,
more masculine.
But it's theirs.
I've had it. Now we're injuncting your book.
And we're injuncting a woman who's, so like, let's be honest on the free speech on that. Now, Sheryl Sandberg is called out there too. I have never been a fan of Sheryl Sandberg, to be honest with you. Even
this
before,
is Ms. Lean In.
This is Ms. Lean In.
COO.
And the reason I never liked it is because Lean In for me, the way she was pushing it back in the day was always about the best way for women to succeed in business is lean in and be like the guys. And I'm going, well, that's not going to help anyone. And she's shown exactly how much she meant that because this whole broligarchy is out of control. There are a few oligarchy companies who for years now have been determining the narrative. We have taken, you know, this idea of data imperialism where, you know, the computer made me do it. Data says, computer says yes, no, and lost all sense of humanity when it comes to leadership. And this is something I have spoken about endlessly. If anyone looks at my LinkedIn or hears me speak in anything, this is, but she's calling out who he was, what they were doing. They have been, Facebook have been absolutely clearly responsible for a lot of human rights issues around the world, controlling a narrative around certain political views.
She highlights the scolding they got from Barack Obama following 2016, and also the Myanmar involvement.
And so I remember talking to one of the ministers one day and I said, you know, the US, and when it comes to regulation, have a Britney Spears model. And they said, what? I said, oops, I did it again. So to regulation. So it's basically, oh, well, you know, we did the wrong thing. Go in and apologize in front of whoever, the committee in America. And then they go back again, apologize again. But nothing changes.
There is one piece from it that I think is worth highlighting, which is the desire for Facebook to get into China and the tactics that were used, including, according to the article, other methods were tried too. In 2015, Zuckerberg asked Xi Jinping if he would do him the honor of naming his unborn child. Xi refused.
So what I think is, well, do you know what? I'm going to mention this now. It's coming out later today. Alva, you'll be aware of this. Kathy Scott from the Trailblazery has just, there's going to be an interview launched later on today with an interview they did with Michael T. Higgins. And actually in it with President Higgins, he references, you know, the two richest men in the world, cage fighting. He said basically species failure. It's a brilliant interview worth watching.
Okay, on that note.
But it is.
We do have to move on, unfortunately, because a break is heading in our direction. Joan, thank you. Joan Mulvihill, Digitalization Lead at Siemens. Likewise, big thank you to Alva Smith, activist and campaigner, and Pada Tobin, leader of AIM2.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.